This is LabCast, ideas and insights for the expansion stage senior manager, hosted by OpenView Labs.
You've been with Moz for a while, I know, but what's the transition been like for you so far? I know taking over for someone like Rand, I don't know if it was intimidating or challenging in its own right, but how has the transition been so far for you?
The best answer to the question about the transition, it's good to sort of talk about how we've related to each other since the beginning.
Right.
So I was the eighth employee at Moz. So while not a founder in the sense of like there was no business here and I got together with a partner of mine and then, you know, sketched out a business plan and sketched out what the first product might look like. I'm not that kind of founder, but I feel very much like a founder, right? Because it was extremely early and we had no idea what we were doing and there was so much to do and so much opportunity and it was a first time everything, right? I mean, I was coming from law practice and Rand and I both looked back and laugh with some chagrin that that we went down this path of having a technology startup, right? I mean, that... it's so unlikely.
Well, I know Rand, because Rand's history too, it's not like when he got started with Moz, this isn't exactly how he envisioned his future, right?
Oh, God, no, because, so I get really, like, envious is not quite the right word, but, and jealous isn't quite the right word, but I wish I was one of these, the kind of founders I usually meet today, where it's a very intentional founding, right? Where somebody is like, I'm going to put together a business plan because I have this great idea and I have a passion about how the world could be different if I apply my energy to it. And they put together their plan and they build the product and they're doing the modeling and they go to a great accelerator that teaches them to ask all the right questions about, did you validate this with real users? And what's really the size of this market? And, you know, like all those great questions that no one asked Rand or I because we didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
I mean, he grew into it as a, you know, I'm going to help out my mom with her business, her marketing consulting business at the time. So why did we start talking about this? Oh, yes, because of the transition.
Right.
So I say that because our relationship from the beginning, it wasn't ever one of Rand knew what he was doing and he was the CEO with a full, like, these are all the things we're going to have to accomplish in our startup. So Sarah, I want you to go do these things. It was both of us just like together figuring out like, okay, God, what's a problem? What's working? What's not working out? Should we do it? And luckily we have really different talents and interests. Mm-hmm. And so he would automatically be drawn toward and add a lot of fantastic value around like the marketing, the brand, what are marketers facing as challenges and what gaps should we do? And then I had a lot of interest on like, how are we actually going to build that? And how will that actually work today? And did we do what we say we were going to do?
Right.
And then also like I have the legal background, right? So I had HR and all the legal stuff. And I learned a lot about business modeling and finances because I loved it. And Rand has no interest in that.
So kind of the balance of creative and the practical and...
Yeah, I mean, neither he nor I would separate it as creative versus practical because there's...
You both kind of have, yeah.
Right, and he is extremely analytical about the research he does around what might help something rank better or not.
Okay.
Incredibly analytical and practical.
Right.
Just like I flatter myself, can be very creative about solving a business problem.
Right.
And working with the team, all that kind of stuff. We just had different things we were drawn to.
Okay.
So working alongside each other, we've both learned a lot. We've grown a lot. We made a lot of really stupid mistakes, but survived them. So when it came time where he wanted to transition out of the CEO role and I transitioned into it, there were a lot of things about it that weren't hard at all. That were stuff that, I've been doing that part. You know, I'm already talking to investors. I'm already managing the team. I'm thinking strategically. I was on the board.
Right.
You know, I was the president of the organization, and it wasn't that big of a shift, right? And then there were other things about it that are much more of a personal challenge for me.
Right.
Things I wasn't doing before because they're ranked superpower.
What sorts of things would that include?
That includes, for example, this interview.
Right.
I was very internally focused at Moz and with our sort of business vendors. But Rand has a superpower about like interviewing and public speaking and he's got his 10,000 hours and more.
Right.
And he's so good at it that it's like, course he should be doing that, right? And then I'll focus on this other stuff, which is cool too. And now as a CEO role, though, where I don't ever want to be Rand, I don't aspire to do exactly what he did. At the same time, the role does require some more external representation,
right?
Plus, I'm in a unique position to be a great example to others who are looking for sort of non-traditional founder and CEO role models, that I take that as a great privilege to be able to be that example.
So
I am doing a lot more, like, just radio interviews and television, and it makes me really feel awkward and uncomfortable.
But then
the other stuff, not as bad.
Yeah, I think kind of the challenge there, too, is Rand set kind of such a high bar. He was so good at it.
I know.
that it would be intimidating, because it's hard to step into those shoes and feel like you can do it as well as he. I'm sure you can, but for me, it would feel like, how am I possibly going to live up to that standard?
Yeah, exactly. And also, the good news is, like, I hope I have, like, the maturity and the grace to say I don't ever have to be as good as him.
Right.
It's totally okay for him to be better than me at this.
Right.
I just have to be, like, good enough in this part of the role. Because, like, the role is very complex, and the role is very big of CEO. And the public sort of speaking interface part of it is a piece.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't the only piece. It isn't the keystone piece. I don't have to get an A+ at it. I just have to, like, not do badly.
Right.
And I can hopefully still add value.
Right, you know? For sure. Taking a step back, because I think it was interesting talking about your relative inexperience in building a company, not knowing what to do. Do you think, while that probably had some challenges and some disadvantages built into it, do you think to a degree it was an advantage too? Because it seems like Rand, following kind of how this company grew, took a very non-traditional approach to transparency and engaging with customers and partners that a lot of companies maybe don't take. They're afraid to put themselves out there, and he took the totally opposite approach. It was, this is who we are. This is what we do. You can see us. We're not putting up any walls. You know, we want you to know who we are, and that's that. I think to a degree, maybe a more experienced entrepreneur not that this is a good thing or a bad thing, maybe they aren't willing to do that. So do you think that was kind of an advantage for you guys? Because it seemed like you kind of grew your customer base and your fans organically that way.
Yeah, I think this is one of the really interesting challenges of growing as a leader. Because sometimes when you grow as a leader, you have the benefit of all this knowledge you've gained. Because mm-hmm. you've tried so many things, and some things worked and some things failed. And so whenever a problem is presented to you as a leader, you have this interesting choice point of, do you come forth and say, you know what, we tried doing a promotion like that in 2009 and it totally flopped, so let's not do it.
Right.
And that's the benefit of my experience. Or do you have alternatively as a leader, you say, we tried it in 2009. This is, you know, the results. It might be different this time. Mm-hmm. What would we have to do to make it different this time? Or what would have to be true to make it different this time? And let's try it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is that is judgment, that is experience. But it's hard. Right? You have to allow that just because you've learned something before doesn't mean it's going to happen again the next time.
Right.
And so, you know, the original question, though, is, as a first time everything, is that an advantage or disadvantage? And certainly there were many things about it that were an advantage, because we did just follow our hearts and our guts and, like, how we wanted to work so much that we came up with our real authentic way of doing things that made it. Hopefully a lot of other people liked the way we were doing it too and wanted to help out and be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also just made it really fun and easy for Rand and I to contribute so much of ourselves into it. Right?
Sure.
When you love what you're doing and how you're doing it, it doesn't feel like work and a sacrifice in the same way. It's hard, but it's rewarding.
Right.
You know, because you're just doing what you think is right. So certainly, I mean, I think that it was different. When I reflect back on my career, there were two points where I thought about quitting at Moz. One was in the early days, because there was just a lot of challenge and a lot of growing pains. We didn't know how to price products. We didn't know how to grow products. We didn't know how to hire teams. We didn't know how to let go of people. We didn't know how to build high-performance teams. And that led to a lot of really hard conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And Rand and I didn't always agree. And I really valued the friendship. I mean, he and I had a friendship before we started working together, right?
Right.
So the reason I'm at Moz, thank God, right? Where would I be if we didn't have that friendship?
Right.
And And I thought, like, God, I don't think I want to keep disagreeing with Rand because I really like this friendship, and maybe I should leave because that might be my best option for preserving the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Luckily, both he and I, because he thought about firing me too, right? We talked about it, you know, after the fact. You talked about that time in our relationship.
Right.
Luckily, we both stuck it out and kept at it and kept talking and went back to the table, looked for common ground, learned from each other, and our relationship is so much stronger,
right?
So, like, wow, we both come a long way, and now I value that. Really, I really truly value that. Another time where I thought about quitting was when Moz was probably about 50 people, growing quickly. Things were going well, like 100%, you know, product revenue growth year over year for several years in a row. And I had that inner critic, right, that self-doubt kind of persisting. I'm a first-time everything. And then, unfortunately, I went to my fear place of, and that means I probably shouldn't be in this role. I probably shouldn't be able to do it, right?
Sure.
And so I was really worried, like, hey, Moz probably doesn't even need a COO. I was the chief operating officer at the time. You know, maybe they should fire me. Maybe I should fire me. Hire a CFO who really knows what they're doing because I was running finance.
Okay.
Hire a real CMO because I had been running marketing, not doing it very well. And, you know, and then get a great VP of HR and, you know, that would probably be better for the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Specialist who knows what they're doing, who can bring that experience to the team.
Right.
And it took a lot of professional development, digging deep, and getting great mentors around me to help me work through that. Like, just because you're the first time, it's a first time everything, doesn't mean you're the wrong person for the role.
Sure.
Still have a ton to contribute.
Right.
But, you know, I need to focus more on the opportunity of I look at problems in a fresh way.
Right.
And then just make sure I have the right support around me to reach my goals.
Right.
The team to reach its goals.
I think that's a key kind of tipping point for a lot of founders, though, too, that feeling that you had of, as this company grows, do I have the skills needed to take it to the next level? And a lot of times you do. I think it's like you said, it's a matter of confidence or self-doubt. When you really dig down and you look introspectively, you probably do have those skills. It's just a matter of deciding whether or not maybe it's a confidence issue. But I think the one thing that's that you can convey is that sense of just authenticity and willingness to put your ego aside, which Rand clearly had too, and has.
Yeah.
I don't mean to speak like, yeah.
Totally. And it's weird because in a way I was right. Right. I'm not the CFO of Moz's future.
Right.
I was able to do it to a point. We have a great CFO now doing a fantastic job. And, you know, between Moz's, where were we? Probably like 11 million or something to, last year, right. Which was like 29 million. You know, I increasingly relied on external help from experienced CFOs. So I was still the internal person in charge of it, but I relied on outside contractors because it was true I didn't have the technical skills, but that doesn't mean I wasn't a big, big part of making our finance team the best it could be.
Right.
Right? Organized. It just means I had to supplement my weaknesses and get really smart about what those weaknesses were and get the right help at the right time.
Right.
So in some ways I was right. I wasn't the VP of HR of our future. I wasn't the CFO of our future.
Right.
But I still was the right person to shepherd us to the, whatever the next phase of growth is, while keeping focused on what is my highest contribution?
Mm-hmm.
What is Sarah's biggest purpose and wants?
Right. And so I don't mean to belabor this point, but to have you touch on this too, because this is another, I think, important point for a lot of founders, is surrounding yourself with the right advisors and the right people. Because maybe you are the right leader for that role, but you don't necessarily have the knowledge or the skills that you need to get to the next level yet. But if you have the right advisors, the right investors, or whatever surrounding you, then you can get there. But it's the key is to have those people, that kind of network or that circle, supplementing what you already have, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And the right people... Right people around you, the best people around you, the people I learn the most from, are able to hold a mirror up to me that I can see those weak points, the skill gaps,
mm-hmm.
And they can do it in a way that isn't threatening or a personal attack to me.
Sure.
It's like, wow, Sarah, you know, to be great at, to have the finance department that we're going to need, we're going to really need someone who's really deep in securities law and GAAP and, you know, different kinds of debt financing and, you know, I don't know, I know you don't have a background in that, so like, let's figure out how we can get you the right support.
Right.
And that is, that's just such a nice way to do it. Because you're right. Okay, you're right. I've got to, we've got to find the right team member to help me,
right.
to help Moz do
right.
it. And not, not everyone I know has that kind of team around them who can give them that insight into their own blind spots in a way that is right. still very empowering and that a way that is still solution oriented.
Sure. Absolutely. That's, I think that's critical advice, because I think the ego can get in the way sometimes, and then the fear of exposing yourself and saying, this is what I'm not good at, this, these are my weaknesses, help me.
Yep.
So,
and Peter, you're walking that sort of knife's edge of being vulnerable enough to get the help you need and to be authentic and to recognize your weak points, but not giving into fear,
mm-hmm.
like, and then having a lot of the negative behavior that can come from when you wallow in fear, right? Lack of decision-making, lack of right. confidence, all that kind of bad output if you get stuck too much in the fear zone.
Right.
But if you're overconfident and it gets into ego,
right,
right, you're also not going to make the right choices.
Right.
Right? You're going to make the wrong choices repeatedly, and
right.
no one's going to want to work for you, right?
Right.
So it's this knife's edge that I think we constantly balance at different phases and sometimes throughout the day between,
yeah.
right, am I being humble enough and vulnerable enough, or do I need to be like more directive and confident here because my gut is telling me what to do and I need to trust it.
Right. You've talked already about some of the transitions that Moz has gone through, some of the lessons that you've learned as you've gone. I know the rebranding was a big deal. So I think every startup experiences those things at some point. There's going to be a time when you pivoting is the buzzword, but there's going to be a time where you run into a wall and you got to figure out where to go. And then maybe you reach a certain point of growth and that's your ceiling. Now, how do I get to the next level? So what are some of the transitions or acquisitions or this rebranding that you've gone through? What are some of the lessons you've learned from that? Going back to the point, things that you wouldn't do again.
Mm-hmm.
And then also decisions that you made that, you think, you know, really set the course for where you are now and where you're going.
Yeah. It's a great question, right? One, again, that you can, there's many layers to it and we could talk about for a long time, preferably in a bar somewhere, right? With nice Jameson.
Right.
On the rocks or something.
That's
but
something
anyway,
yeah.
What we have is a webinar, so we'll
right.
talk about it here.
Right.
You know, I think that we made a lot of big bets in the past 2 years, right? And as you mentioned, one of them was the rebrand. We did several acquisitions. We rebuilt our legacy flagship product from the ground up. And we had a lot of other operational stuff going on, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like a whole new building and leadership changes and like all this stuff.
Right.
Move off Amazon to our own data centers, like just a lot of other, there's
right.
a lot, right? We changed basically everything in the business that you could change.
Right.
I don't know that anything stayed the same,
right.
actually.
For a company that was already doing well and, you know, it was successful. It's not like the company was, you know, on a downturn in disaster mode.
No, we were getting ready to scale and
right.
I still am getting ready to scale. Like we're continually getting ready to scale to that next level.
Right.
And so some of those bets really paid off very well, and we executed pretty well on them, right? Like the move off Amazon to Dallas has been a good one for Moz. It's not for every startup. That's a bigger conversation, but it's been a really good one for us.
Mm-hmm.
The rebrand, actually, while challenging, went really well. The brand awareness of Moz, it's just as strong as SEO Moz,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, people weren't shocked when we did it, and there's still a ton of brand loyalty around Moz. So I give that one like A marks. It was later than we thought we would do it, but it still went really well
mm-hmm.
and the results have been great. The I think the one that gave the organization and me personally the most challenge and sort of like grief and self-reflection, right, was how we executed on the rebuilding of our legacy product.
Okay.
Which is a big deal, right?
Right.
We had 20,000 paying customers on it.
Right.
We used to hit, you know, not every day, but almost every day,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't a little change. We had this vision of, gosh, how do we take some of the new technologies that are in prototype phase? How do we build them in? We'll need whole new back-end infrastructure. We need to create a middleware layer, which we've never had before,
mm-hmm.
get the whole thing to be a more service-oriented architecture to be able to get to future development velocity,
okay.
right? Plus, we wanted a whole new front-end that brought in all this information in a new context and a better, richer experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to branch from, you know, just being very SEO focused and making it clear that we had all these other technologies in social media and fresh web mentions. And we wanted to make it clear that we weren't just SEO. We had these other pieces. Mm-hmm. And that was part of our thesis, that marketing is changing to be so much more cross-disciplinary, and that, you know, SEO isn't just, you know, on-site page audits and links. It's, it is that, but it's also all this other, these other activities, right? So we had a thesis around that, which was the impetus, the sort of why I go through the effort of taking a successful product and scrapping it and rebuilding from the brand, right?
Right.
And unfortunately, we just executed it in a lot of the really wrong ways, right? We were way too waterfall. We spent tons of time in the planning phase and detailed specs, which we thought was going to really help us not make problems down the road, right? We thought,
sure,
if we really spec this out in a very detailed way, it'll help our communication because the engineers will know what to build and we'll keep on schedule because we'll have anticipated problems.
Right.
Unfortunately, right, what one of the things that does is it delays getting started in the actual building.
Mm-hmm.
And two, when you get a plan that you spend a lot of time on, you become more and more wedded to that being the right plan because you put so much of your energy into it.
Right.
That closes off your creative thinking to alternative ways of seeing what you've built,
mm-hmm,
or alternative ways of even doing it in the first place. Right.
Right.
Actually, I just finished reading Creativity, Inc.
Okay.
By the Pixar guy. His name I just forgot. Andy something. Whatever. Great guy.
Yeah.
And he talks a lot about this part of the creative process, right? The balance between you have to do enough planning to know what you're trying to do and to communicate it, but not so much that you get wedded to a really terrible idea.
Right.
Right. So we were very waterfall, huge plans, and then we shifted to, we said, okay, engineers, here's your very detailed spec that we put all this love into, you know, and we vetted it with our favorite, very loyal customers, which are the wrong customers to vet ideas with.
Right.
Turns out, right? Those, yeah, are not the customers you should go to.
Right.
What do you think?
Right.
Go to the risky ones.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they'll tell you they love everything about it, right?
Right? They're,
yeah,
just like, oh my God, it's beautiful. We're like,
right,
I know.
Yeah, right.
Actually wasn't very useful, unfortunately,
right,
though, right?
Right.
So we put it to the engineers, and then, and we also, unfortunately, told our engineers that we really wanted to release it all at once and with our rebrand, because we had this idea in our heads that it would be this wonderful sort of magical day of launching and like it'll create so much good energy and discussion.
Right.
It wouldn't be this great thing to unveil it. And we,
right,
were very marketing focused, which is also a terrible way to build product and a pressure to put on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, builds so much greater risk into the project, right? So the other thing with that is we didn't have the right process that would help us reveal problems in the development of this. So we thought maybe it would take 9 months to a year to build, and it really, it took just over two,
mm-hmm,
2 years, right? So the launch kept getting pushed back and pushed back. And we didn't have a good way as leaders to check in on the progress of it that would have highlighted for us much earlier that there were big problems with how we were building it.
Sure.
There were really serious execution problems, right? Some of it was, you know, silly stuff, right? Like what we really should have demanded of ourselves as a company, like, let's just build a small piece of it.
Right.
let's just be agile. Let's just focus on rebuilding this one piece and this,
right,
one service and see how we like it. And if that one works, let's build another piece on top of it, right? And,
right,
then if that one works, that's great.
Right.
And then we would have been checking in along the way,
right?
Right? And also learning. We wouldn't have waited till the end to be like, oh, shoot, that didn't work out how we wanted.
Right. And you have so much of yourself, your time, and everything,
yes,
invested into it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that engineering team was off cooking, trying to code this gigantic, very detailed spec that we were in love with. They were trying sometimes to communicate, like, hey, we're not sure that this is a good idea to do it this way. And we think this scope is totally out of reach, right? But
right,
for various communication challenges and process challenges, like, that message did not get communicated well.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a leadership team, because we had so much going on, we were totally, you know, our attention focused on all these other aspects of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of learning, a lot of regret, too, about, you know, how I decided to contribute and participate in that process.
Right.
That I hope we've all learned our lesson as an organization. And I think we have, because we are doing things a lot differently,
right,
than we did last year. A lot differently. We're much shorter cycles, really, you know, team autonomy.
Right.
We're really focused on what can we release this quarter and try not to overplan.
Mm-hmm.
Try to just, like, let's learn and chunk it off a piece at a time.
Right.
Better user feedback.
Well, I think that's that kind of goes back again to the right leadership, conveying this sense of leadership where your people feel comfortable to come to you and give you feedback. Because a lot of times there isn't that sense. there's this fear that if you say something to the CEO or whatever, the CEO is just so caught up in believing this one vision they have for the product or for the company.
Yeah.
Everybody's afraid to speak up. But with you guys, it seems like that's, you know, you're still going to have mistakes and you're going to, yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting about Moz, and I obviously will never know because then I'm speculating on a lot of people's inner consciousness that I'd probably be doing. But I don't think at Moz it was, I am afraid of you being angry at me or afraid of you losing your job. I think it was, I don't want to disappoint you because I know you're so committed to this. And I know I'm a really smart person, and so we're just going to make it happen. Like, like really smart people. There's been research on it. I'm not going to quote it right because I never do. But like, that basically, the smarter you are, the worse you are at predicting how much time something activity will take you to do.
Right. It's fascinating.
Because if you hire really smart people, it means like, oh my god, you're going to be really bad at predicting how long it takes. And that's not malicious, right? It's like a very like good natured, like we can do it. It's like optimism gone wrong.
Right.
You know, optimism gone to delusion.
Right.
That I think. You know, hopefully we all, this is my experience, I hope I am getting better at catching myself in my own delusions as I get older, which is what judgment is, right? Why judgment grows, right? This is such an interesting challenge because as a leader in the organization, right now the CEO, it is my job to think ahead. It's my job to think strategically. I should be spending most of my time thinking strategically, right? A year down the road, 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, anticipating market needs, right? The company needs. At the same time, just because my job is to create that vision and communicate it, that can't translate into the process of how we build again. Because the building of it process does have to be so incremental, quick feedback, learn as we go. And I think it's hard for people to balance that. Like some leaders are either totally in the let's only talk about what's happening this month, right now, moment, sort of like, you know, every day you're up to your elbows in crocodiles and you're just like in like reaction mode, right? Trying to do this one little thing and they're not moving the big stuff, right? And then at other times, so focused on the big long term, you lose track of like, well, how is this actually going today? It's a challenge and it's just, it's how you talk about it as a team. It's the strength of your leadership of knowing how to translate big ideas into smaller tactical milestones, and then having a good communication process that is constantly feeding the information you're learning back into your long-term process.
Right.
Constantly growing.
Right.
Or changing and evolving based on what's really happening on the ground.
Right. The last theme or group of questions here is related to being a female CEO, especially in the tech world. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of times you don't necessarily want to be pigeonholed as a female CEO. You're the leader of the company. It doesn't always have to be about this gender gap. But it's a relevant issue, especially in the VC world, in venture-backed tech startups and growth stage companies. So do you feel, I know you talked earlier about kind of a responsibility, you know, in the position that you're in to kind of be an example and to show whether it's other CEOs or other female CEOs, how you kind of operate in the right way to do things. So there's no real question in this, but kind of if you could react to what's happening and then how you feel or the role that you think you play in this issue, I guess.
Yeah. I always want to preface this part, these kinds of questions with I'm very aware that my experience does not represent the experience of all women in tech, right? Because that is the great and wonderful thing about this world is that we're all individuals and we're all going to have very different contexts within which we're working. So that aside, right? That like firmly with the sort of disclaimer, I'm trying very consciously not speaking for all women in tech.
Right.
On a personal level, I have not experienced overt gender discrimination that I know of. Right. Like I've never felt like, oh, that person, that VC didn't fund us because I'm a woman, or that partner didn't want to do business with us. That vendor didn't want to do business with us because I'm a woman, or that employee doesn't like me because I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. Now it may be happening and I'm just oblivious. Right. And I have three brothers.
Right.
I maybe just like miss this stuff.
Right.
I don't know,
yeah.
Right?
It's just at this point, you just kind of brush it off your shoulder. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Right? But I do know that it happens for other women, right?
Sure.
Like other women have examples, and I believe them to be true, of some terrible, terrible interactions, right? So again, that's where I don't want my experience to be interpreted as like there's not a problem, because there certainly are problems that we need to work on. So so that aside, like of my own experience, you know, I have actually felt very nurtured. I think there is a lot of heightened awareness right now that the tech industry is not as representative of all the people on the planet as we want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And gender is a slice of that. Sexuality is a slice of that. Race is a big slice of that that I don't think we talk about nearly enough either.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think everyone is feeling that anxiety of the gap between what we want our industry to look like versus what it actually looks like.
Sure.
Which is good, because you have to talk about it and be aware of it in order to impact change.
Right.
So in response to that gap and that anxiety that I feel from it, you know, I go out of my way to remember that a lot of times people just need to see any kind of role model. Anyone different than sort of what they think of as the stereotypical person in that role is helpful. I'm not going to be someone's, like, you know, conversion moment to technology if they weren't going on that, but I can hopefully be a little bit like, oh, there's a lot of different kinds of people in tech.
Right.
There's a lot of different ways to do it and succeed. And, like, you know, Sarah's one of them. And, like, maybe that'll give someone, you know, a little bit further hope along the way.
Right.
When I think about the full pipeline, so there's stuff I'm doing at Moz right now that is very much, like, how could I get more diverse technical people in my organization today? And we support things like, you know, Code.org and Code Academy, especially when they focus on special groups for women. There's a great Seattle organization called Ada Academy that I'm very proud of that takes women who have already had a career and then does an extremely intensive one-year program where they try to, like, cram as much computer science skills into these young women as they can and teach them Ruby on Rails so that a year later they can come out, you know, great software engineers.
Right.
I'm a supporter of that, right? And I have one of their interns working with me right now, and we'll have another one in 6 months. And then I also... that's a very, like, in the moment, getting software engineers today, kind of end of the funnel, effort. Another thing we're doing, actually, the same end of the funnel kind of thing, is we're really investigating our own interview tactics, right? Are we interviewing in a way, that really lets all kinds of people show their actual skill set?
Sure. Yeah. Our
interviewing techniques are a filter, are a lens through which we try to perceive someone's skill set. But we may be not getting an accurate picture based on the techniques we use.
Right.
So we're experimenting with some of that.
What are some of the techniques? So you don't have to go into too much detail here, but just what are some changes that, you know, just so if someone's watching this, they can say, you know, we're doing the same thing. Maybe we should make those changes.
So a great engineer in my organization named Kelsey Foley is putting together a presentation for gracehopper.org all about interviewing techniques, which I'll try to send you the link to later so you can update your post. But one of them, for example, is do we, in whiteboarding interviews, very classic thing, right? Hey, here's an array, you know, and then you try to, you know, code some problem out of it and then walk us through it. That may be biasing you towards extroverts in a really interesting way. Like, an introvert may have just as much, if not more, skill, but failing at that interview.
Constantly. Right. And that jades your opinion of them. Yeah.
And once someone is rattled, even if they're a top performer, and we're all like this because we go into, like, our fight or flight brain, right? We go back to, like, lizard brain.
Right.
You're rattled, and then your creativity stops, right? And so you're not actually getting the benefit. And so... Right, trying to get back to the intent of, like, what we're trying to discover is, can this person solve problems and can they code?
Mm-hmm.
Whiteboarding is one way. And so, for example, historically, we've done, like, whiteboard interview after whiteboard interview after whiteboard interview. So it'd be, like, you know, 3 or 4 hour blocks of whiteboarding.
Mm-hmm.
That's exhausting.
Right.
And rattling, and may not be the only way or the best way to discover someone's real skill set. Like, what if instead we gave them a sample problem and said, hey, go take this sample problem. Here's a business question we have to answer. Here's some data. Go create us a Rails application to solve it and build a little test on it. And, you know, take a few days and then we'll come back in and you can debrief us on what you learned. Because I don't actually, like, I really just want to know if they can code and how they talk through it and the problem solving. It's not that we don't code with each other in front of whiteboards down there.
It's not,
right?
Yeah, like, it's not a real world application.
Yeah, right. They have their own compilers and they do, like, and I don't, like, of course everyone is going to, like, try to Google to see if there's a common solution out there, and which is, like, a smart thing to do, right? So, like, there's a lot of interesting sort of, like, I would say sort of legacy holdovers and understanding of how you actually test for aptitude that may be at a disadvantage if someone's coming to the interview already feeling a little bit nervous about, I've got to outperform in front of this person.
Sure.
So that's not just about gender, although gender plays a piece, right? That could be male or female, and you know, any race or anything could be subject to the dynamics of that interview in a way that is really not transparent to their true skill.
Sure.
So that's an example of sort of end of the pipeline stuff, right? Okay. And then I'm also on a personal level committed to like, okay, I want to help create the pipeline. I don't want it to have be an excuse of just, well, there just aren't enough people at the end of the pipeline ready to work.
Right.
So I talk to like anyone who has a class of middle school girls that they want to inspire for STEM. I'm like, sign me up. I will go talk to any group of girls about STEM that you want. And I talk to girls in college. I talk to high school girls, right? Like,
yeah.
I am committed. I'm a very strong believer that we need to get computer science curriculum into middle school, junior highs, and high school because we've got to just broaden that funnel. We've got to expose way more people to this science. This is the science of our age, and that it's not considered, you know, just as important as biology or something is, it's crazy. It's getting increasingly crazy.
Right.
So I'm a huge proponent of that. I think that will dramatically change the landscape of what technologists look like.
Right.
Because like the socioeconomic stuff drives me crazy too.
Right.
It's so hard for someone, unfortunately, born to a a poorer area or socioeconomic class to overcome that. It's really frustrating.
That's
it's one piece of a much bigger puzzle.
Right. Absolutely.
You've got to attack on many different fronts and in many different parts of the pipeline.
Right.
And I would, I want to acknowledge that I think it's, because whenever you talk about this conversation, it gets perceived as man versus woman.
Right.
And that's really frustrating to me because it's totally not, right?
Like,
there's room for all kinds of people to do the work they want to do, right? And I don't think that there is a malicious effort out there to, oppress women and to keep them out of business. I don't think, I have never met a VC who's like, guys, we got to make sure the women are, they're out of here. Like, I don't, I know that's not how it goes, right?
In
fact, most people I know in the industry, like I said, have the anxiety about, we know there's a gap.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how to cross that gap. But most people I know would love diversity. They don't know what to do, right? And I think there is a lot of great information online that I would encourage people to look at around, small behaviors that they can take that won't on its own with one person at one time cause a revolution, but en masse can, And it's around stretching your comfort zone to mentor people who don't look like you or come from your background.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it's not human nature to do that because we all want to mentor people who are like us.
Right.
Because it's a relationship,
mm-hmm.
and it's okay that it's a relationship.
Right.
But I think to have the change we all want to have, we're going to all have to stretch a little bit and say, like, I don't know if I'm going to have very much in common with this person, but, like, I'm going to give this a go and genuinely invest.
Right.
And so I can help them.
Yeah.
It teaches you something. And, when I talk to young women in particular, I tell them very directly, like, don't just look for female mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Look for any mentor who can help you.
Right.
And they're not going to be all like you.
Right.
And don't forget, it's your opportunity to show them a new side too.
Right.
If they do somewhere have a sort of very subconscious level prejudice, you are going to be part of changing their lives. And like, that's good. That's an opportunity.